Okay.
Good Erev Shabbos, everybody. This week's parasha we know is Parashas Yisro, and we're going to talk about the title of the shiur is Good and Evil, Concrete and Abstract, and what that has to do for people in recovery and for addicts. So let's take a look for a minute at one of the psukim in the parasha, when Yisro tells Moshe who he should choose to have as his delegates to be able to minister to the people and to provide them with guidance. So Yisro describes a whole bunch of qualities that the individual should have, and one of them he says is Anshei Chayil. Rashi, over there, it's Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Rashi says, what are Anshei Chayil? Literally, we would say in English, people of valor, whatever that means. But Rashi says, Ashirim. They're wealthy. Shein Tzrichim L'Hachnif V'Lahakir Ponim. They don't need to flatter anybody or show anybody extra recognition because they're wealthy. And that's what Yisro was saying that he should choose. Now, there's a little difficulty over here, because they're in the Midbar, and at this point they have the Mun, and we know Simlosa Lobosa Mealecha, their clothes didn't even decay and deteriorate. What exactly is the need here to have wealthy people? You know, Anshei Chayil, everybody had everything that they needed. So, well, in a Pashup Shat way, there are a couple of answers that you could give. One quite possibly that Yisro was giving Moshe general advice that would stand for even past the Dar Midbar as the kinds of people he should select. But let's stay with that question, right? What's the need for Moshe to choose wealthy people who would have no fear and would not need to flatter anybody when clearly nobody was starving and their clothing and all their needs were taken care of? So we're going to come back to that question a little later, and that will be a way to illustrate one of the points of today's discussion. But going into the Pesukim, we start at the beginning of the Parsha, where it says that Vayishma Yisro Choen Munjen Chosein Moshe as Kol Asher Asa Elohim LeMoshe Ul Yisrael Amo Kiyotzi Hashem Es Yisrael Mimitzrayim. So it says what? That Yisro heard about everything that Hashem did for Moshe and the Jews, they took the people out of Mitzrayim. It's an impressive piece of news. Yisro was, one would assume he was affected by that. However, it actually doesn't record Yisro's reaction at that point. It just says Yisro heard it. Then, later on, when he meets Moshe, it says, Vayisapra Moshe l'chosno, Moshe told his father-in-law everything that Hashem did to Paro and to Mitzrayim, Alados Yisrael, the happenings of the Jews, all the travails that occurred to them and how Hashem saved them. So Moshe now tells over to Yisro everything that happened, even though it already says that Yisro heard everything that happens. Moshe told it over again. And then Yisro says, Atu yodati ki gadol Hashem mikol elokim. I know Hashem now. Now I know Hashem is greater than all other gods. Ki v'davar shazodo aleim. Because it was, according to Chazal, it was mida k'neged mida, whatever they tried to bring against the Jews, Hashem brought back against the Mitzrayim. So the Klei Yakar raises a number of questions here on the sequence. First of all, it says Yisro heard everything that happened. So why is Moshe telling it over to him? He already heard it. Then, when Moshe tells it over to him, only then Yisro says, oh, now I know Hashem is great. Yisro heard it before. What changed? Another interesting detail that the Klei Yakar points out. Klei Yakar says, when Yisro heard about it, the focus is on everything Hashem did for the Jews, because it says, Ki Yotzi Hashem es Yisrael Mimitzrayim. that Hashem took the Jews from Mitzrayim. When Moshe is talking to Yisro, he stresses everything Hashem did to Paro and the Mitzrayim. So there's a change in focus also, that what Yisro heard was about the good tidings that happened to the Jews. And Moshe is telling over the punishment that was exacted against the Egyptians. So what's going on here? So the Kli Yakar has a very interesting insight. And he says as follows. He says that, as was true amongst many ancients, including Yisro, there was a belief that good and evil were not necessarily under the jurisdiction of the same God. So that actually the thinking was that there were multiple forces, at least two. There was a God who was in charge of doing good and a God who was inclined to do evil. And therefore, the way the Kli Yakar sets it up is, when Yisro heard that Hashem took the Jews out of Mitzrayim and did all the miracles for him, he thought, okay, the Jews have a nice God in their pocket. He's good to them. He takes care of them. That didn't impress him enough. What's the difference one Getzka for another Getzka? You know, what's the difference one deity for another? Then when he heard from Moshe that not only did Hashem take the Jews out of Mitzrayim and do good, but Hashem also is capable of punishing the Mitzrayim and exacting punishment against them, and it was Kasher Zadu, what they plotted to do. In other words, it was very specifically done to be Mida Keneged Mida and to benefit the Jews. It was payback, and it was to benefit the Jews, but it also was punishment at the same time for the Mitzrayim. Yisro began to see that this was one deity. This deity, this God, was capable of doing good and evil, so to speak. Obviously, it's not evil ultimately, but doing things that are experienced as good and things that are experienced as evil from the same power. And that was the root of a monotheistic belief, which we'll talk about in a minute, because monotheism is not just about believing in one God. It's much deeper than that, and we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about character development, and we'll talk about addiction and how all this connects. But for the moment, the Kli Yakar says that that's what won Yisro over, and that's why only after Moshe told him the story, then he says, oh, now I see Hashem is greater than all the gods, because this is a God that's capable of all facets, that he's not limited in any way. And this must be the supreme being, the supreme God, because he's not in charge of just one jurisdiction. He doesn't just do good. He doesn't just do evil. He doesn't just give reward. He doesn't just punish. He runs the whole show. And that was what won Yisro over. Now, let's go back and talk about what really is going on over here. So, from a psychological point of view, it's important to understand that monotheism itself it represents not just another new belief, an important belief. It represents a higher degree of development of mankind, and I'll explain in a minute. Avraham Avinu, who was the pioneer of monotheism in his time, right? He discovered on his own, really, and promulgated the idea that instead of having multiple rishuyos, having many gods, there's one God in charge of everything. And at the same time, another signature trait of Avraham Avinu was that he did chesed to all, right? He had his ohel; it was open to four sides. He did chesed for everybody. What's the connection between the two? The connection between the two is that if one is a monotheist, if one truly digests the implications of believing in one supreme God who's in charge of everything, all the good things that happen and all the, quote, bad things that happen, then it also forces a person to have a different level of morality. Because, you see, if let's say you're not a monotheist, you're over to Avodah Zarah, and you have a particular god, who's your favorite god? So your morality is only going to be aligned with whatever the agenda of that god is. If it's the god of fertility, then you'll do things that will bring you toward fertility, and that's what the cult of Baal was about. If whatever the god was, a god of war, you'd fight war. There's no morality. The only morality would be oriented around the particular agenda or power of that god. If, on the other hand, everything in the world is subsumed under one unifying force, then the person has to contend with all the impulses and all the needs and all the character traits, because they're all coming from one ultimate designer and one ultimate will. So Avram couldn't say, I'm going to be good to my countrymen, I'm going to be good to my family, or I'm going to be good today. Avram had to be good to everybody and everything, because it all came from Hashem. And just like he saw that Hashem did chesed and created everything and willed everything into existence, he had to then, of course, show great respect and love for everything that Hashem made, and it all was under one God. So there's no way that he could split these pieces off, and it created a level of morality that is very different, because there is no side door, there is no excuse. You have to take it all in. Everything in the world ultimately has a purpose. Everything is ultimately based on some grand design from one unifying force. So that's why monotheism represents an advancement. It's not just, okay, so Hashem tells us shake a lulav. Hashem tells us believe in only one God. It's not just a regular mitzvah. It's about creating a mindset. From a psychological point of view, it also represents a tremendous advancement, because what we understand about infant development is that when an infant is early on in his career as a human being, when he experiences something pleasurable, he enjoys it. And then when he experiences something painful, he can't necessarily understand. He does not necessarily understand that the good and that the pain and the pleasure are coming from the same source. There's the same mother that loves him. And originally he develops a more primitive idea where, well, there must be one good mother and one bad mother. The good mother does all the good things, and the bad mother does all the bad things. And that's a much less sophisticated idea intellectually. As the infant experiences, if he does, a more continuous and consistent attachment, connection to his mother, the infant begins to develop this idea that this mother is another being, and the good comes from her and the bad comes from her. So when he's nursing her, it's the love that she's providing. And when there's frustration and that his diaper's wet or something's going wrong and she's not able to take care of him, it's also the same mother who's in charge. And that's a psychological level development that people have to really work on their whole lives, because on some level, instinctively, people regress back to that other level of seeing good and evil in not the same person. And it actually makes it very difficult for people to tolerate relationships, because what happens is basically either you're with me or you're against me. If someone hurts you, then you can't be connected to them because they're other. If they're good to you, then you love them. That's actually not differentiated. From a psychological developmental point of view, differentiation is a very important notion, which is the idea to understand that good and evil, good and bad experiences, they could come from the same relationship and the same experience. And so, in terms of both a religious point of view and a character development point of view, being able to have a religion where the God is in charge of everything that happens forces the recipient, forces the worshiper, forces the individual who must connect with that God to understand that this is all part of one relationship. The good and the bad, the easy experiences and the hard experiences, they're all connected. And it's because of this that the Torah has such a terrible reaction to Avodah Zarah and even to graven images, because you have to go one step further, that it's not just about understanding that good and evil come from the same source. It's about concrete versus abstract. One could argue that one of the tasks that the Torah puts before the one who follows the Torah is developing a greater appreciation for abstraction and moving away from concrete thinking. So, for example, that we're not even allowed to make an image that's even representative of Hashem, we can't do. We're not allowed to do that because we cannot concretize Him. We have to understand that there's a piece, that there's things that are beyond our ability to fully comprehend and be able to connect on that level. Now, in a slightly different way, the Rambam in the Mor Devuchim in Chelek Gimel, Perek Lamed Beis, he does essentially make the same point. It's a much more complicated issue over there, but he does make the same point. For those of you that want to look it up, you'll see it's part of a greater discussion. But in Chelek Gimel, Perek Lamed Beis, he talks about the idea that many of the mitzvahs in the Torah are a bridge between the concrete and the abstract. So, for example, korbanos or tefillin, fasting, all these things are ways to achieve an end, right? The end is some type of spiritual connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu, but they can't just be so abstract because it would be impossible for humans to digest trying to connect to Hashem without the means of some kind of activity. So putting on tefillin is a symbolic representation of Kabbalah Shel Malchus Shemayim. Karbonus is a kind of worship. It's a way of showing Hakaras HaTov, of connecting with Kadosh Baruch Hu. We're seeing that this is like sacrificing yourself, or whatever pshatim you want to give to Karbonus. But the Rambam says that the point is not the activity. The point is the state of mind that the activity creates. And therefore, for example, the Nevi'im would have messages from Hashem to the Jewish people, where Hashem is very frustrated with the insincere avoda, because it wasn't the avoda, it was the sincerity. So, for example, right in Yeshaya Perek Aleph, it says, "Lomali rov zivchachem, Yomer Hashem. What do I need all your karbonos? Savati olos elim vechelev meri v'dam." I'm satisfied. I'm full with all your olah offerings. What do I need them for? And it's very strong, actually, those psukim. They're really quite strong and beautiful. He says, who asked you to come into my courtyard and trample with your feet? Who asked you to do that? I don't need you to do that. Because, again, they're not really coming with sincere minds. And Chodsheichem Wadechem Sono Nafshi, Hashem says, your Yomim Tovim, your Rosh Chodeshes, I hate them. Hoyo Alay LaTorach, they were a bother to me because of the insincerity. Right? So the issue is, because the Kabbalists, the Rambam says, were very important in Mitzvah. Everything in Torah, every single word of the Torah is important. But the purpose of it was to create a frame of mind of attachment to Kadosh Baruch Hu. So one can understand, in essence, the Torah experience is one of bringing man from concrete to greater abstraction and being able to understand abstractions. Now, getting back to Anshei Chayil. So Anshei Chayil, right, our original question was, why is it important for these individuals to be Anshei Chayil, to be men of wealth, when there was no need for wealth in the Midbar, when they had mun and their clothing never wore out, and all those other wonderful benefits. And so the point is that people become enslaved to their needs, and the purpose of the Torah is to elevate people and create a greater appreciation for the abstractions over the concrete. So, relating to Anshei Chayil, it wasn't about material wealth. It was about Chazal's definition of wealth, we can say, right? Chazal, in Pirkei Avos, Perek Daled, Mishnah Aleph, they turned everything around every way that one would look at intelligence, power, honor, and wealth. In one Mishnah, they turned it all around, right? What does it say? Ben Zoma Omer, Ezeo Chacham, Halomim Mikol Adam. Who's wise? Someone who's intelligent? Someone who has brains? No. Someone who learns from everybody. Ezeo Giver, who is strong? Someone who's got muscles? No. Hakovish is Yitzro, someone who conquers his Yitzhara. Ezeo Asher, who's wealthy? Hasameh Pachalko, someone who's satisfied with his lots. So someone who has a lot of money? No. Someone who feels satisfaction, right? Ezeo Mechubad, who is honored? Someone who gets a lot of honor? No. Hamachabit Esabrios, a person who honors other. So the Anshei Chayil was not talking about material wealth. It was talking about a frame of mind where a person is no longer enslaved. They're freed from the bondage of self. And a free man is always free because his mind cannot be enslaved. And a person whose mind is enslaved is never free, no matter how much money he has. Right? So the Torah says, there's the Gemara in Erevin talks about a play on words, right? The luchos were called chorus. The luchos were engraved, but the Gemara in Erevin on Daphne Dalad says a play on words. Al tikri chorus, don't call it chorus, don't call it engraved. Elecheirus, it's freedom, because the Torah represents a formula for man to free himself from the banalities of the physical existence and to elevate himself into a being that appreciates abstraction. So instead of being some animal clawing away and trying to make a few bucks and trying to have a few moments of pleasure, right? The Torah is developing the psyche and the character of a person that they can appreciate true wisdom, true wealth, true strength, all these experiences that are actually more abstract. Okay, so how does that relate? How does that relate to addicts? The way it relates to addicts is that addicts could be understood as having a supreme problem with an inability to see the abstract over the concrete, because the addict sees an immediate need, whatever his particular addiction is, whatever his drug or process that he's addicted to, that becomes the immediate, all-encompassing need. And if he were capable of abstract thinking, right, if he were capable of understanding who is wealthy, who is intelligent, who really enjoys life, who experiences pleasure, who feels love, if the person was able to understand the abstraction that is the ability to make long-term goals and meaningful activities as the basis of your wealth and your pleasure, then the addict would have an easier time overcoming his addiction, so that the experience, right? One experiences a terrible desire for something. It makes no difference whether it's a desire for sex or a desire for alcohol or a desire for food, right? You're in the grips of that desire because your mind and character have failed to make the leap from the concrete to the abstract, right? The abstract is you want real connection, you want real pleasure, so a momentary sexual act is not going to bring that, right? An act of love and connection and bonding with one's spouse in a committed relationship, that is going to bring the ultimate feeling of pleasure and belonging and connection and ecstasy. You're hungry, you want food, you feel hungry, and you have a diet, and you have to listen to your diet, and you don't, you make yourself sick. That's not gonna take care of your body. That's not gonna nourish you. So all these ideas really are about the triumph of the concrete over the abstract. I'll just end with one of the slogans in AA is "Remember your last drink," and I believe that the idea behind the slogan is that you have to remember, if you want to stay sober, you have to remember what actually happened the last time that you drank, right? And whenever a person does give in to their particular substance or process they're addicted to, right? The momentary pleasure, sometimes it's not even pleasurable, sometimes it is, but it fades very quickly. And then afterwards comes a feeling of regret. At the moment that you're in the throes of that desire, you got to remember the last time and remember how unmeaningful it ultimately was, how unsatisfying it ultimately was. That's the triumph of the abstract over the concrete. So just give me a moment. I'm going to shut off the recording and open up the conference call for questions and comments, but I need to program it. Give me a moment here.